Comedian Jimmy Pardo has a really fun new podcast. It's called Playing Games with Jimmy Pardo, and you can listen to it ad-free and 1 week early on Stitcher Premium. If you listen to Jimmy's other podcast, Never Not Funny, then you're going to love this one. Joined by a different celebrity guest co-host every week, Jimmy welcomes three call-in contestants, testing their knowledge of movies, TV, music, and headlines from the last 5 decades. Guests so far have included Nikki Glaser, Scott Aukerman, and there are going to be so many more great ones coming down the line. So check out ad-free episodes of Playing Games with Jimmy Pardo 1 week early, only on Stitcher Premium. For a free month, go to stitcherpremium.com/playinggames and use promo code MOVIE. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Crack Movie Club, the show where we try to make you an expert in your favorite films. I'm Tom Ryman, and with me today is my guest host, Bridget Greenberg.
Hey, guys.
We're the self-appointed crack movie experts. We're here to point out some things you may or may not have noticed about your favorite classics and drop observations that might ruin the movie for you, or maybe not if you're mature enough to handle it. For the next hour or so, we're going to be discussing the following film, 16 Candles from 1984, directed by John Hughes. With us today is our guest, Christy Harrison, who's a senior editor at Cracked.
Hello.
Hey, Christy. Before we begin, we like to ask, when was the first time, Christy, that you saw this movie?
Ooh, okay. Well, I'm 41, and this was in heavy rotation on my slumber party circuit. So I'm thinking, yeah, like about 88. So probably about when I was 10, 11 years old is when I first saw this. And I would say that it was not as popular as Pretty in Pink, which I hope you guys are going to also tackle at some point. Is that on your list?
No, I don't think it's a Hughes one. I don't think he directed it.
Did he not?
Did he?
No.
Marley Ringwald? Molly Ringwald worked with someone else?
Right.
It's like, not?
No, it's Howard Deutsch. Hughes wrote it, but...
All right, not far off.
Oh, that's right. That's where John Cryer plays Ducky.
Yeah, that movie's
with
amazing.
With his Eddie Munster's Widow's Peak. Bridget, when was the first time you saw this movie?
My mother showed it to me, and I was probably around 13, 14, something like that. I was just coming into the teen years.
Did she say? What was the context? Was she like, this is going to help you, or this is what you need to avoid? And she sat you down to watch it.
I'm going to give away how young I am right now. So she was probably late in college or just graduated when this movie came out, and she remembers loving it, and she loved showing me her favorite movies. Mm. So she's like, this is one of mine. And I saw it, and I also loved it at the time. I thought it was great. It was after I saw The Breakfast Club, and I was like, that's great. And she's like, I got more for you. There's a ton more where that came from.
Just a whole sack full of John Hughes movies.
Right, and it's where I got introduced to how great Joan Cusack is.
Oh, yeah, she's perfect.
She's perfect, and the movie needs to be about her. I did have the idea in my head after seeing this movie where I was young and attention-seeking enough to be like, I wonder if around my birthday, if I just don't bring it up, I just social experiment, want to see if my parents
will forget
about it.
Oh, man.
And then, of course, they didn't because they loved me and they're great parents. But I was super like, I bet they would forget. And I had no siblings getting married or like important things going on.
My parents woke me up to say happy birthday.
They were super sweet, and I was like a little disappointed about it because I was a bratty 13-year-old.
I wanted them to forget.
I wanted them to forget, and then I wanted to be angry at them.
So something else we like to do, Christy, if you would please humor us with a brief, you know, 1 to 2 sentence summary of the events of 16 Candles. You've written us a treatise. Let's see if we can pare that down.
I wrote a treatise, and I'm very sorry. Okay, a 16-year-old girl wakes up on her birthday. Her parents forget that it's her birthday, and she slogs through her day thinking everybody's forgotten her. Then there's a party, and the next day is her sister's wedding, and oof, that's bad. I did not do a good job. I'm sorry.
that's fine. That's pretty much what I've got.
What did I miss?
It's not a plot-heavy movie.
No. Watching this again, how little really happens.
I know. I have a distinct memory of, like, her going to the party, and it's, like, a bunch of party hoppings.
Mm-hmm.
But no.
No, it's just the one party.
It's just the one party.
It's the one dance and the one party.
And she's not there.
Yeah.
And she's not even there.
Yeah, that's right. She leaves.
She's asleep for most of the movie.
Yeah.
She's asleep.
Yeah, for, like, the second act of the movie, she just checks out.
She misses all the action. Our main character.
Well, that's a pretty decent sum up. On this show, we like to compare your plot description to a few of our own rudimentary summaries. Christy, feel free to join us in our segment, Terrible Loglines. A pair of date rapists trade victims for a day.
A foreign exchange program allows a neglectful and racist family to adopt a Chinese student.
A woman sleeps through her wedding after her xenophobic parents drug her.
Rich teenager keeps missing connections with richer teenager.
A well-meaning father waves his daughter off as she skips her sister's wedding to lose her virginity to a relative stranger.
His foot is almost in that cake, too. Like, yeah. When he leans over to kiss her, it's like, dude, you're way too close to that cake.
A community of people with bad hair slog through their awful day. Mm.
Jake Ryan has great hair. How dare you.
A man doing fake pull-ups with his friend asks for advice about statutory rape and heroically ignores his friend's correct advice.
I forgot that. That dude's totally correct. Yeah. I barely listen to him because I'm like, you dumb jack, as these movies taught me, but he's right. A town of awful people leave a foreign exchange student injured, drunk, and alone.
He has an awful experience.
He really does. Yeah. They're terrible people.
Christy, do you want to hit us with one more?
Oh, I've got two more. Unlikely associates party together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And my last one is elderly grandparents sexually harass their granddaughter.
They do.
Yeah,
like her grandmother
do.
Straight up grabs her boobs.
Yeah, it's a line in the movie she looks like directly at Cameron and says, my grandmother just groped me. It's like, yeah, you should say that to some sort of police hotline.
Yeah, you should call Child Protective Services. Yeah.
And the line is, she fills her up. She says something like, my grandmother just fills me up. But the line was that the grandmother says something like, oh, she's got her boobies or something like that. And the grandfather says, I need a microscope or something, or a magnifying glass. It's like both of them.
Right. Yeah. They shame her. Yeah. One just goes and grabs, and then the other shames her.
Handsy grandparents, man. Yeah. And she spends the rest of the movie moping about how she doesn't have the bod to fit into her bridesmaid's dress. Why do you think she's like that? Because of these shaming grandparents. Body-shaming grandparents. All right, now that you know the plot of the movie, let's dive into the making of the movie from pre-production to post-production in a segment we call Expensive Pretending. So John Hughes wrote the script over a single weekend with Molly Ringwald's headshot hanging above his desk for inspiration. That's a little strange.
That is super creepy.
Yeah, apparently what had happened was he had his agent give him a bunch of actresses' headshots because he's trying to figure out he wants to play the part. And the headshots included Ally Sheedy and Molly Ringwald. And he had initially cast Ally Sheedy.
Right, that's what I thought.
Yeah. But then he got Molly Ringwald's picture and he's like, oh, my muse. And then he made like four more movies with her.
Did she know that at the time?
I don't know.
I can't imagine she did.
I mean, there's a way to put that where it's not so creepy. I mean, you can be inspired, and it's just, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. We don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to write something for Molly Ringwald. I mean, I would put her headshot up, but I'm allowed, I guess. I don't know.
Right, you're not a 50-something-year-old man.
Right. Yeah. How old was she when she was cast, I wonder?
15.
Do we know? Like, 15. Okay.
Both she and Anthony Michael Hall were 15 in this movie. And he also wrote the part of the geek specifically for Anthony Michael Hall after seeing him in Vacation, which he also wrote. But he did audition a lot of people for the geek. He didn't write flat out cast Anthony Michael Hall.
Because, right, Jim Carrey was going to be...
Apparently, yeah. I can't find confirmation of that, but I did see that on like a trivia website online. So. Yeah.
I can't imagine Jim Carrey as a child actor.
No. Like, how old would he have been?
He wouldn't have been a child. No. You need to do the thing
Although
Jim Carrey
he,
does. You need the confidence
was in Peggy
of someone.
Sue.
That's true. Yeah, go ahead.
He was in
your
Peggy
thought.
Sue
yeah.
Got
yeah.
Married as a teenager. Kind of like, he was in Peggy Sue Got Married playing a teenager, but he was still Jim Carrey. Like, I don't think he ever looked like a kid. Anthony Michael Hall is my favorite casting in this movie, and also just in general, everything he was in the 80s.
Yeah, no, I super agree with that.
Right for...
I definitely agree. I think he's the best character in The Breakfast Club. Apparently, Jim Carrey was 22 when this movie was made.
Ah, all right. I mean, probably passable.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the guy that plays Jake is like 24. So,
that makes sense.
Yeah, and for that part, that's played by Michael Scofield, but Viggo Mortensen was the other
Oh no!
almost cast
Oh,
Jake.
Boy.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to talk about somebody who has never not looked like an adult, that's Viggo Mortensen.
It's Viggo Mortensen. Also, I cannot imagine him having the charm you need in order to pull off some of the stuff that Jake Ryan does. Like, you need to be the obviously too handsome 80s guy.
Right.
And, like, Viggo Mortensen, he's in a trap, but he's not Jake Ryan. Like, he would have made that creepy.
Yeah.
He's obviously, like, in a way we would have been in the 80s scene.
Well, apparently that Viggo was the one that Molly Ringwald was more into. She was like, yeah, Michael was handsome, but Viggo was the one that really, like, really made me weak in the knees.
Well, she was probably cool with John Hughes.
Yeah.
writing with her picture.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I almost wonder if that would have helped it for me, because that character is so bland. And then we get into where he's, like, straight up creepy, but I don't, like, he looks old to me, and he's not interesting at all.
Yeah,
so
no,
maybe a different actor would have been a better fit. I'm not sure.
You're right.
Michael Schaefling, if you're listening, I'm sorry.
I'm not sure that he is. Like, the last movie he was in was Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken. which was in 1991. So I think he kind of was done with acting. You're right. He doesn't have a lot to do. He just has to stand. He looks confused throughout the entire movie. Like, yeah. He wandered in from a different movie and just doesn't understand what's happened to him. He's just aloof the entire time. And he dresses like an adult man. Like, he dresses.
Yeah,
like,
he does. He's super well dressed for a 16-year-old.
Like, looks like L.L. Bean, just like dressed like an Eddie Bauer catalog.
He's got his shirt tucked in.
Yeah.
He's got his hair done.
Right. No belt, though, right? Am I crazy? Was he not wearing a belt? Like, he's wearing his flannel shirt and khakis, but, like, I didn't detect a belt.
Huh. Trendy.
It's a bold choice.
Maybe they were built into the pants. Like.
Oh, yeah, they might have been. They might have been. Good call. Belt.
I mean, I think that's how John Hughes was like, let's age him down. Get that belt out of here.
Yeah. That belt exudes adult responsibility. Let's take that out of there. Let's give him a bit of recklessness. So yeah, Anthony Michael Hall was cast, like we said, even after an audition process, because he, according to John Hughes, he was the only one that came in and played it like a real human being, were John Hughes' quotes. Like, apparently everyone else he saw for the part was doing really over-the-top geek stuff, and Anthony Michael Hall was just doing what we see him do in the movie, where he's obnoxious,
and
he's
dressed.
Yeah.
He's dressed like a prep. Like, he doesn't look anything like a preppy kid. Like, he doesn't look like the way people were doing nerds back in the 80s. He just relied on his actual acting to get the geek part to come across, because he doesn't have any of the, other than the braces, which, you know, lots of kids have braces. He doesn't do the overt nerd thing at all in the movie.
Right. This is after Revenge of the Nerds, right?
I don't know.
The horn rim glasses and the pocket protectors and stuff. And the date rape was all, that was all part of it.
That idea of the 50s style nerd, I feel like, has always been around.
Oh, yeah.
Since at least the 50s. I mean, his friends were nerds.
Mm-hmm. John Cusack.
John Cusack and the other kid.
And the other guy, yeah.
Right.
They were just wearing Ghostbusters helmets all the time for no reason.
Right, they had no awareness of their surroundings.
No, they're just in the movie to...
They did not care.
No. They're in the movie to get stuff in the trunk.
I want to know who that other kid is. His name is Darren something, but I want to find out what became of him, because he was so good in this movie and then, like, the two other movies in the 80s where he played a nerd, just perfect, and then he disappears. And it's like, we found the perfect nerd for 80s movies, and God blessed us with him, and then he went on his way, and he aged out of it.
I'm glad other guy nerd has an advocate in you, though, Kristen.
Right, I think he did the She's All That thing, where he takes off his braces and takes his hair out of ponytail. Did I say the right movie?
Yes.
Nice.
You did.
Yes.
Yeah, and then we're like, no.
Oh, yeah, he became... Yeah,
he became not a nerd, and then Hollywood couldn't cast him anymore.
His braces came off, and he turned into John Hamm.
Yeah. That's who he is now.
Yeah, and that boy was John Hamm.
Yeah.
Some more casting notes. John Capellos, I'm probably mispronouncing the hell of his name. He played Carl, the janitor, in The Breakfast Club, and now he plays, in this film, Rudy, Ginny's douchebag fiancé.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the janitor from The Breakfast Club.
Wow. Okay. That's shocking. I mean, wow. That's my only comment, is I did not see that coming. I liked the
big
janitor
age gap
better.
There.
Oh yeah.
It's bizarre. Big age gap there between.
Yeah, he
seems. I mean, I don't know how
older.
Old the bride is supposed to be, but he looks old. It doesn't look good.
Yeah, I mean, in the Breakfast Club, he balded.
Yeah,
he was bald.
He was balding. Yeah, he appeared to be at least 40.
Yeah, no, he was older janitor, and now he is relatively young groom.
Youthful groom, yeah.
Yeah.
And they keep casually calling him a bohunk, and I had to look this up.
I did, too. I was afraid, too.
At first, I was like, well, maybe that means dummy. That's a phrase I don't know. And then they say something along the lines of, yeah, I hear he's like an oily bohunk. And I'm like, that sounds racist. So I looked into it. It is racist.
Yeah, I heard that and I was like, don't want to Google it. I did not want to type that into my Google search history. Tom was the brave one who did it.
I did. Was bohunk a term you were familiar with, Christy?
Well, no, but I would think the easy choice would be Italian, and they just didn't go for that. So
no
wow.
deeper cut.
Who knew that? Who knew Czech people had reputation? Because it's implied they're mobsters, right? Like the family is dabbling in personal loans.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. No, they're definitely mobsters, and that's why I assumed it was. I mean, I'm about to say something racist too. So this movie brings it out, and by assuming the mobsters are Italian,
it's okay. Christy already beat you to it.
Yeah, this movie brings us all down.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Getty Watanabe, plays Long Duk Dong. That's not a great.
No, he did say another fun fact is he was like, yeah, they added the gong in at post and did not tell me. And he did not.
It's super racist.
Right, because it's super racist. He's like, yeah, I didn't feel great about the gong. And I was like, that's the thing? That's the one thing you're choosing?
Yeah, that's the one thing you didn't feel great about? Yeah, he has received a lot of criticism from Asian Americans about his role. Where I read one essay by a guy who was like, yeah, if you were a teenager in the 80s and you were Asian American, this movie ruined you.
Oh, my God.
Everybody called you Donger.
Oh.
Didn't matter.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yep.
That's really
bad. The one thing I like about it is that he does have the best story of everybody. Like, he later on gets to have a good time. And
yeah,
even
he does
though
have
I
the
don't
best time.
Approve of drunk driving, you kind of like that he wrecked the grandfather's car and then he got to go to a party and he found a girl and he did have a fun time, but beyond the problematic parts. So at least he got that out of the
right. He had story. The most charming adventure.
Yeah, he definitely did. Had what I like to believe he thinks is sex on that exercise bike. Because they make that weird cut to reveal that him and his new American girlfriend are on an exercise bike, but having the time of their lives.
Right.
So.
Having a ball.
Yeah. It's a very strange.
It's not It's not totally clear that they're not having sex. We just can't see everything. They could be having sex on that exercise.
Well, they're fully clothed.
Well, from what we can see.
Yeah.
There are workarounds.
Yeah. There are workarounds, yeah. There are sheets.
Yeah, they're just exercising and having a good time.
Samantha's younger brother is a little kid named Justin Henry, who a few years before was nominated for an Oscar for Kramer versus Kramer. He was, at the time, the youngest person to be nominated for an Oscar. And in this movie, he's a little asshole.
Yeah, he's a sociopath in this movie. And everyone knows it, and no one cares.
Yeah, he's...
He's like a step away from being like, I brought a dead cat home, Mom!
Right.
And like them just being like, oh, you little twerp.
Oh, he's this little scamp.
Yeah.
It's funny that he's the prestige actor on the cast. I didn't realize he's like the only one who has these amazing credits behind him. And then he plays this horrible caricature of a kid.
Yeah. Not cute or charming.
No, a kid that just like memorizes anatomy books so he can make weirdly sexual comments about his sister.
Yeah, he's very creepy with his sister. Both of them.
Both of them, yeah.
Yeah.
He's a little creep, little creep boy.
Yeah, they gotta send him away soon.
Yeah.
Well, they all share a bathroom, so that's probably, like, if you're thinking about how he would know what he knows about what's going on with his sister's cycle, they make a point of showing that they're all splitting that bathroom in the beginning. So, I mean, that part of it, you can kind of figure out that a little boy would figure things from what he sees in the bathroom, but... His treatment of it is
right.
Bizarre.
He's like really excited to let everyone know that his older sister is on her period.
Yeah,
That's
I
weird.
Do not like that kid.
That's weird, kid.
Yeah. Also, you have a seemingly, I want to say, four-bedroom house, one bathroom. Really, Illinois architecture? Really?
Yeah.
That's poor planning. This is my big critique of the movie.
Terrible design for this house.
It doesn't sound right. Yeah. It sounds like there would have been a master bathroom in the master bedroom, but maybe the mom is in there. I'm just picturing this house now because they did all crowd around that one bathroom up there at the top. Yeah, they did. Sorry.
Because there's not even a master bathroom. Really getting into the blueprint for this house.
Yeah.
Because the dad goes downstairs to use what is the one bathroom we know of.
Yeah.
In this house.
But he can't because grandpa took a stinky dump.
Yeah. Comedy.
Because that's... okay, some notable crew members. Jackie Birch, we mentioned her in the last episode. She's a casting director for Breakfast Club. She's also the casting director for this film. And like I mentioned in the last episode, also cast Die Hard and Predator.
Nice.
Three Amigos, really
she
cool.
She casted most of John Hughes movies, too.
I think so,
well,
yeah.
Well, at some point, it was just like getting the game back together over and
right,
over again.
Right, yeah. It was just the same actors.
Yeah.
Ira Newborn was a composer. He also did the music for Uncle Buck, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Weird Science, and Ace Ventura.
Ooh!
Yeah. It's a name that I recognized because I watched Ace Ventura so many times as a kid. I was like, oh, Ira
Newborn.
You
picked up on it eventually?
I know him. And Jimmy Iovine. I'm
what?
Not sure if I was saying
Iovine.
Him. Iovine.
Yeah.
Jimmy Iovine. Was the music supervisor, and Bridget recognized that name, so why don't you tell us who he is?
Yeah, Jimmy Iovine is Dr. Dre's partner in his headphone.
Was the founder of Interscope.
And is the founder of Interscope. Yeah, he's a big hip-hop producer. I cannot believe he did this movie. That's really cool.
Yeah, he did all the, all the pop music and such.
Because I watched a documentary about him on HBO, and at the time he was like a punk running around, like a little kid running around mixing music for like punk bands. So I'm surprised they nabbed him at this time to do music supervising. But that's cool.
Yeah, there's not, I don't think there's any punk songs in this movie.
No, they do a lot of like 80s pop stuff.
Yeah.
Like when they're at the dance.
Yeah.
And at parties. But there's not really like classic needle drops either. Like there aren't a lot of John Hughes movies.
Yeah. There's like
This
is like a weird anomaly in John Hughes movies because this one was still similar to teen movies that were being made at the time, sort of like Better Off Dead, where it's like this, it's a heightened reality.
Right.
Where like these cartoonish things happen and there's fourth wall breaking and stuff like that. And there's a lot of like music cues from old TV shows and stuff.
Right.
Like extended fantasy sequences and things like that, which he sort of shed all of that immediately in the next movie, The Breakfast Club. So this one is a little more absurdist, I think.
It is.
In spots.
This is John Hughes' first movie, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, they probably didn't want to give him the money for a cool song at this point.
Yeah, that's true. He was making this and The Breakfast Club at the same time. And The Breakfast Club was supposed to come first, but Universal switched them around because they felt like this movie would be more commercial and it had the bigger budget. I think this one is a budget of like $6 million to The Breakfast Club's $1
million. Which one did better in the box office?
Breakfast Club.
Well, yeah, because it came out, music supervising stuff is stuff that happens in post, so they probably just waited to give them the money when they found out, like, oh, this guy's onto something. You can have a song.
Yeah, they really got behind this one, I guess, because it was sort of a broader
right.
comedy about, and then, you know, Breakfast Club is more, like, moody.
Yeah.
Yeah, similar to The Breakfast Club, this was filmed just in locations around Illinois, mostly in the North Shore suburbs, Chicago, Highland Park, Skokie, and Evanston. The interior school scenes were filmed at two different high schools, Niles East High School and Niles North High School.
Rivals.
They wanted to play them against each other.
Yeah.
I think the dance scenes were filmed at Niles North, and like the classroom scenes were at Niles East.
Hmm.
I'm not positive. I know that Samantha's bedroom, her attic bedroom, was actually a set that they built in the gym of Niles North High School because they needed it to be big enough and be able to, you know, like
right, that makes
camera around in there.
That's how you save money on locations. That's the old producing trick. They also mentioned that it was like 101 degrees while they were filming that gym scene, and they had to like one of the actress that plays her friend at the dance had to change her dress like 16 times.
Oh wow!
Because it was so hot in there.
One for each candle. Yeah, yeah, no, they were filming in the summer of 1983, yeah, and they couldn't run the air conditioning because
you can't run the air conditioning while you're filming because of sound. So film sets are unpleasant places to be.
Yes, they are.
They are, well, behind the scenes, they are not glamorous. It's always very hot, and there's so many people in
it's
there.
Incredibly hot. Oh,
yeah,
my God.
And yeah, when you have a scene like that with 16 people in a gym that is 100% smaller than it looks, it is uncomfortable in there. I cannot imagine what that scene was like. I do not want to be in there.
I wonder if they used high school students in there, because you can never tell in the 80s like how old people are because of the styling. Like, you, her friend looks 45, but it's only because you know she's wearing mom hair.
Right.
So I wonder if they like just brought in local kids from that high school to come in and do all the classroom scenes, because it is a big production, right? That looks
that's a lot of extras, and you can kind of tell. I think they did, because in the scene in the beginning where they're coming up, where she's coming off the bus at first to go into school, they have like a row of kids coming off the bus, and I'm like, oh, those kids look young.
Yeah.
And then you have Molly Ringwald, who I can't believe is 15 at the time, but looks older. But all the kids coming off the bus, if you pay attention to them, they're like, those are definitely high school kids. Like, they
children.
Did a good job, whoever casted those extras. But I wouldn't be surprised if
I think so. Just, I think I read that on some of the kids, you can see that they have like the actual, they're wearing like clothes that have the actual high, like Niles North High School on it or something. So they're like actual students there. But I'm not positive, but it does make it.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. They would just use the kids there.
I always thought she was older than she is. It's, and I always thought she was like, she had to be like 6 feet tall. She's not that tall, but she's got to be five. She's tall enough to hold her own next to her co-stars usually, right? In height, or taller than Anthony Michael Hall at some point. But she just looked so much older than she really was. It's hard to believe that she's only 15.
Yeah,
in
it is. Yeah.
Movie.
Yeah, that, I keep talking about when they're coming out the bus, because that scene really struck me. It's like, oh, all these kids look young.
Because when you're watching a movie about teens,
right,
none of the people playing them are teenagers ever. So, like, you sort
of
forget, like, how young a teenager is until, and, like,
right,
so, like, you're seeing these actual teenagers, like, oh, they're children.
Yeah.
Like,
The kids on the bus would be young children, because, or the younger version of the high school kids, because that's real life. Older kids drive their cars to school,
right,
or ride with their friends. So it has to be like the 14 and 15 year olds.
That's
also, when they come off the bus,
freshman and sophomore, right?
Yeah,
everybody's empty handed, which is a huge mistake. They need their books, they need their backpacks, they need their lunches. They walk off the bus with nothing in their hands, one after another.
It's a town of irresponsible parents.
Right. Anthony Michael Hall has nothing when he comes and sits down and starts harassing Molly Ringwald. He's got nothing.
No
backpack, no lunchbox.
But again, we're in a town of terrible parents that just like see their kids out. Like, they're out now? Great.
Perfect.
Time to do cocaine.
Yeah.
The original poster for this film, listeners should look it up. It has a fucking novel written at the top of it. There's like so much text at the top of it. I think it took what Christy wrote in our notes for her plot summary and just printed it across the top.
I was
going to
say that.
Like, they really wanted to explain everything about this film.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's the original Breakfast Club poster is the same way, where there's this wall of text at the top.
That's so...
It's so weird.
Yeah, they literally sum up the whole movie.
Yeah, we don't need that, like, that's...
They weren't worried about spoilers in the 80s. This is the whole movie.
Nope.
From the poster. Like, so you're, like, picturing high school kids at the movie theaters, and there's like, they're in line for other movies, and then they get to this poster, and there's like a log jam because they have to like read the whole thing before they can move along.
Yeah, also this tagline doesn't make sense. It's a time of your life that may last a lifetime. That has nothing to do with this movie.
Yeah, like, what does that mean?
I'm gonna use any of our log lines.
Right.
That is more relevant to this film.
So when it came out, maybe perhaps owing to this poster, the film was just a modest success. It grossed about $23 million on a budget of $6 million. It really blew up on VHS, which was pretty new at this point in time in the mid-80s. Movies still cost like $90, and that's apparently where Christy saw it.
Yeah, we would rent it from, you know, go to the video store or whatever, rent your VCR, rent your videotapes, and everybody watched this one. Again, did not have the same prestige as Pretty in Pink, which everybody has to watch because it's the better version of every Molly Ringwald story.
It does have 100% more Andrew McCarthy in it.
I would say, like, I'd be
old
interested.
Old crazy eyes.
Yeah. That's what we used to call them. Real crazy eyes. But I'd be interested to see, like, how much, if John Hughes movies really contributed to the explosion of, like, the home video market. Because those, they're all movies that feel like they're so kind of personal in a weird way and relatable that you'd want to watch them at home.
Yeah, particularly like The Breakfast Club. I can't imagine seeing that in the theater.
No, yeah, they're very, one of the things he's great at is making these, like, really personal and relatable stories that you kind of just want to watch with your friends or at home. So I wonder, if he really contributed to the VHS blow up.
He might have. This one definitely feels more broad, and it's perhaps because it was only, you know, a modest success that they really, like, for The Breakfast Club, were like, okay, you get $1 million, John Hughes. You stretch that $1 million. No Nicolas Cage for you.
Yeah, one scene in a gym.
Yeah. Okay, that's how the movie was made. Now let's get into some of the cool observations and junk in a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Bum, bum, bing.
Secret things. Okay, so for, like, symbolism you didn't notice, I couldn't really find a whole lot of symbolism in this movie.
I don't think this is a very
textual
nuanced
movie. There's a lot of...
I agree.
...weird wealth ideas, like wealth...
Yeah.
Strange ideas about what it means to be wealthy and what exactly being wealthy is, because I don't know if they ever explicitly say it, but, like, Molly Ringwald's family is supposed to be, like, middle class, I guess.
They live in a very nice house.
And they live in a fantastic... It only has one bathroom.
One bathroom, but...
Very nice house. And then you get to Jake's house, and Jake lives like a... He lives in Wayne Manor.
Yeah, Jake is clearly very wealthy. He's a wealthy, popular boy.
But he doesn't, like, know anything about his wealth.
This movie is taken straight out of the Reagan era.
Oh, yeah.
It's very much of that time frame, because everyone is... Like, even the middle class people are clearly very wealthy and just don't realize what they're doing to each other. Like, they don't care. It's very strange. I don't know what point I'm making now.
Yeah,
but it's... Yeah, this movie shows wealth very strangely.
Yeah, it's... I'm not sure what it has to say about it.
I think it's just, like, a limited perspective. I think it was just, like, this is John Hughes's version of the 80s, which is these stereotypes of just, like, white kids living in the suburb.
In the suburbs, yeah.
I don't think it's supposed to be thought of too much. I think it's just, like,
kind of is what it is.
Yeah, it's just very, like, encapsulated in the 80s, kind of.
If we could go, like, in the future, and I bet there's a lot of references to this movie later, like the 16 candles at the end of the birthday scene, and I it would be easy to find symbolism that references this movie from movies going forward because it was so iconic. But I really watched this. I had this note in front of me, secret things, symbolism, and I couldn't find anything that I thought was, like, bigger than what I was watching, and other than, you know, the problems I had with it. And I think I almost wouldn't mind going back and watching it with an idea of wealth and privilege, like you were saying, like watching it with that kind of analysis.
Well, there's
a lot to say about
there's definitely something about absent parents, because the only sets of parents we do see are Samantha's, and they forget her birthday. That's, like, the point of the film,
right?
We don't see Jake's apparently an orphan. We don't see anybody else's parents. And then, like, the way that Samantha's parents are apathetic toward her is similar to the way that they're apathetic toward Ginny, who's marrying a fucking monster.
Yeah, I mean, he's also clearly a mobster, and she's about to get, like, embedded into a crime family, and they do not care or do anything to stop her.
And she's so drugged during her wedding that she can't stand, and they're just like, yeah, we're going to go along with this.
Yeah.
Like her father, I think, says something to the effect of, I'm going to miss this wedding that I paid for, when they find Long Duk Dawn bludgeoned
Seven
in the front yard.
Yeah.
That actress is great. Is really funny in that scene. To her credit, she is doing some really funny physical comedy.
It's really dark, though.
It's very dark, but I thought it was hilarious when I first saw it. And I'm watching her just, like, from acting now. And she's very funny in that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you wipe out, if you take away the fact that she's on drugs and getting married and nobody's stopping her, just from a pure comedy, she owns.
Yeah,
you know, she brings everything to it, and it's funny.
Yeah, but yeah, it is hard to get around that she is drugged at her wedding, and no one cares. There, this is a big wedding in a big, nice, fancy church.
Yeah.
Also, a terrible wedding. It looks like just the worst wedding.
Yeah, it's like a shitty.
But like, not one person goes to stop it or say like, maybe this is a bad idea.
Right.
Not even the priest who is there is like, she might be a little too high to do this.
Not even Father Brian Doyle Murray.
Yeah,
that's real dark. Christy, you had a note about the shower scene.
Yeah, who was that for?
I don't know.
Yeah, teenage boys.
But please continue.
But this isn't a movie for boys, is it? Would teenage guys like gather up with their friends and put this in the old VCR? This was a movie for girls. Which, you know, maybe girls want to see naked women, but it doesn't make sense as a scene. It's like so naive to think that, maybe not naive is not the right word. I just can't imagine who John Hughes was going for when he put that scene in there. And I've got a lot more to say about it. Maybe I should do that now. Like, that scene is so weird because it doesn't understand anything about high school, like how a high school functions during the day and how much time you have, because she's just like luxuriating in the shower like for 20 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
It doesn't understand that this character, Sam, is so preoccupied with her like embarrassment and wanting to avoid embarrassment. But if she were caught looking at another woman naked in the shower, that would like stay with her for the rest of her high school career. That would be her defining moment of high school. If anybody saw her and her old friend watching someone shower, and it just didn't, everything about that scene plays weirdly. And then I think they put a boing sound when they show this woman.
They
dressed.
Do. Yeah.
It's
100%
a boing.
Yeah. It's really jarring cut.
Yeah. Just all of a sudden like boom.
Yeah. I think there's a quota in 80 movies that you have to show just like one pair of boobs.
And you could get
no reason.
You could get away with it in a PG movie back then. This movie is PG.
That's incredible.
In the first 10 minutes, Molly Ringwald drops an F-bomb, and then we see bare naked boobs in a shower. Pair of supposedly teenage girls' boobs, and the actress was not teenage. And that's actually not her in that scene, because she wasn't comfortable doing it.
Yeah, clearly, because that's a very leering shot.
Yeah.
It's a very sexual, it's not,
yeah.
This is just like another person showering. It's like, look at this chick's body, and it's uncomfortable.
Really...
And then they're, yeah, you're right, there are people watching, and like, if she got caught, that's a better movie.
Yeah, really. It's like, what the fuck are you doing?
Is that deep cut drama of this girl's life being ruined because she watched a peer shower, which is weird.
Yeah, not watching is too gentle a word. They're like,
leering.
They're like leering.
They're leering. And they're also talking about like...
how disgusting she is. Yeah. Like, that's what they're talking about.
No, they're talking about that she's great.
Well, but like, they're like so...
They're disgusted that she's a good person,
yeah,
which in this town makes sense because everyone's like, terrible.
Yeah. She's like, she must have failed like 6 times. It's like, no, people develop at different rates.
At different speeds.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's
You're
fine.
Probably making her deeply uncomfortable
right,
too.
Yeah.
Like,
body shame this lady.
Yeah. And they're just
this
like
teen girl.
And they even say, I heard she's a great person. She's really nice to her deaf brother. And is good at school. And
but
then,
they say it with such contempt.
With such disdain. Like, and then, like, they set up that she's a good... I forgot that she's supposed to be a good person in this movie because they just treat her awfully throughout the whole movie. She
yeah,
gets, like, date raped and then drunk to the point of passing out and is supposed to be shamed. But then they talk about, like, yeah, she's actually, like, a super nice person, though.
Yeah, that's...
Well, I think he... Sorry.
No,
I think he figured this out later because she should have been a bully. There's no antagonist in this movie and there's nobody for you
You're
to
right.
be mad at. And she should have been just evil. And so once again, in Pretty in Pink, they figure that out and they give Molly Ringwald some bullies who make fun of her for being poor. And
right. And Judge Reinhold.
And Judge Reinhold.
Judge Reinhold is a bully.
He's a wonderful bully.
He's a great bully. But yeah, you're right. That is interesting. She's supposed to be the villain, but like does nothing villainous.
She does, yeah.
Except for get drunk at a party.
Yeah.
Which is not a particularly villainous act.
No. Like
she gets her hair cut off. She has an awful night.
Yeah.
And we have no reason to hate her except for that she's pretty.
That segues into what I had written down for our next segment about non-intuitive arguments about things in the movie. We're calling this segment Let's Overthink It. And yeah, this movie hates attractive young women.
Yeah, it's really mean.
We were talking a lot about Caroline, who is Jake's girlfriend, who is punished throughout the entire film for doing nothing to anyone. She's just pretty.
Her only fault is that she's pretty in this movie.
Yes.
She's not mean.
She invites everyone to the party. I think that's the piece where she's the only thing that she does. Like, he didn't want the party. She knows the parents are out of town and invites her friends, and then they all trash the house. And that's the one thing. But you don't deserve date rape for that.
No. I mean,
I forgot. There's also a weird part in this movie where John Hughes shames her for being on birth control in the script. She feeds the geek a birth control pill and then says, like, now we're both on the pill. You know what that means. You can be as careless as you want. And it's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that point. I was like, whoa. I feel really uncomfortable about that line.
She's really, like, almost the most mature person in, like, other than getting really, really drunk, which is, again, not something that you need to shame about. She, like, presents herself in a way that's really mature. She has this relationship with her boyfriend that's almost like they're an old married couple, the way they relate and talk to each other.
Yeah.
And
they have a super amicable breakup.
Yeah, they have, like, a very mature breakup.
Yeah. And then I think about, she's on birth control. She's taking care of that part, too. So,
right.
Yeah.
She's being responsible.
She's, like, super mature.
Yeah, and so I think, wasn't this at the point where you still had to have your parents' permission or something to get birth control? Am I not remembering that correctly?
I mean, that's probably true.
Probably because it's still a prescription. It was always a prescription. So she probably, like, had a conversation with her parents.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, is she had to sat down and talk to her parents about, look, I want to be on birth control.
I mean, her outlook on birth control, meaning it can be as careless as you want, is
it's not great.
Is not mature or great. But that is clearly
understanding of how it works.
Not what that means. And no person who's on it would think that's what that means.
And then, like, sort of less obviously, Sam's older sister Ginny is punished throughout this movie.
Yeah.
And she's a little aloof. Like, she's kind of shitty to Sam in the one scene. But, like, she spends the rest of the movie, like, she's marrying a fucking Jagoff who's, like, he's just a slimy dude who's way too old. Very much older than her in, like, not a good way. She's drugged throughout her entire wedding, so she's not going to remember any of it.
Yeah.
And she just makes a stumbling fool in front of both of their families and everybody there. And then she gets, like, just stuffed into a limousine to be unceremoniously driven away to wherever they're going to spend their wedding night. So,
right. They're not even going to their own reception. That confused me, too. Because they drive. She gets stuffed into the limo.
Yeah.
She gets folded like Pennywise into a limo and shoved in there. And then Jake's like, are you going to the reception? And Molly Ringwald's like, yeah, I am. Is she not going? Is the bride not going to her reception? I don't understand what's happening.
This is
the worst wedding in the world.
Yeah, he's just like her creep husband is driving her off so he can day rape her. Like the implication is that they're gonna have sex while she is still in this state.
I mean, at this point, that is the third woman who that happened to at this point in the movie.
In the shop, when they're sitting in the shop car and Anthony Michael Hall climbs on top of her two times in a row.
Yeah.
And then she apologizes to him.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, I'm sorry if I embarrassed you. And you're like, no, don't do that. No, he is wrong for doing that. He should be embarrassed.
Also embarrassed in front of a whom.
Yeah.
It's so weird that Molly Ringwald's thing is that she was not supposed to be traditionally attractive either. Like, she's cute. That's why the guy's interested in her, which we also need to talk about because there's a problem there too.
Because she's so much younger than him. Go right ahead, sister.
Well,
lay it on us.
I think the one thing this movie does really, really well to me is it establishes that a 14-year-old, 15-year-old is a different person than an 18-year-old. And so you look at the Anthony Michael Hall character and he looks right. He's a freshman, he's 14. She looks older than she is, but she does a good job of kind of conveying inexperience and youth, and she still is young.
Right. She has the insecurity of a 16-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where this movie really hits the nail on the head, because Jake and Caroline are almost like, it's almost like they're already married. Like, they look old and they dance old and they're just,
they dress old.
They're both a different universe.
Yeah.
They're actual
adults.
She's
already got her mom hair.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, she's going to have to get a mom haircut after what happened, just to even that out.
Right. Yeah. That's a tragedy what happens to her hair. Yeah. It's like, just open the door.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. She's the only person acting drunk in the way that, like, drunk people act. Like, she's kind of falling asleep.
Yeah.
And, like, the rest are, everybody else around her are, like, ridiculous drunks. We're like, I'll get a scissor. And she's just, like, falling asleep. I'm like, one of you is making sense in this world.
And then, like,
she's funny too.
Yeah, she's great.
She's really funny.
I feel so bad for this character. They're just so casual about, like, Jake just casually says, yeah, she's upstairs. I could violate her in any number of ways right now. It's like, Jesus,
oh,
man.
Oh, yeah, that was...
Shut up. Yeah.
That made me uncomfortable.
So the thing I'm worried about here, and as a mom, I'm like, this guy has no reason to be interested in Molly Ringwald's character. There's nothing. They've never talked before. She doesn't think he knows that she exists. And, you know, she's, like, idolizing him in a way. You know, it's like a hero worship kind of thing. And
yeah, that's why he likes her.
She's saving her virginity for him, which is so bizarre.
Yeah.
Why are they talking about virginity at this age? They spend a lot of time talking about virginity here. So weird.
The entirety
but
of his interest.
He has no reason.
Yeah, the entirety of his interest in her is stated in that scene where he's doing fake pull-ups with his buddy, and all he says is, "Yeah, she's been staring at me a lot. I kind of like that." That's it.
Yeah. He also steals a note from her in the beginning. And sees that he's got a sure shot here.
Right.
But, he should have been alarmed by the question in the beginning, which was, "Have you had sex?" And she goes, "I don't know." Or, like, I don't think
so. Yeah, I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, that's an uncomfortable answer.
Yeah, that's not great.
She's a baby. She's a little girl. And this guy is just, like...
He's a predator.
The idea is he knows she's a virgin. Like, that's the story you're supposed to get out of
this. Oh, shit. You're right.
That's
why he's interested.
Yeah, that's the secret things. Hidden bullshit.
Yeah, he's like that fucking guy from Kids.
I hate this guy. I'm so mad.
That's wow. Yeah, this movie is
okay,
deeply uncomfortable.
So, it's a crude parlance, but that's...
And the other thing is, and I almost want to write about this, is that there was a time when people could fetishize 16-year-old girls, and nobody minded. And there's, like, all this evidence because of these 50s songs that just put it right there in the title, Sweet 16, 16 Candles, Only 16, and they're all written from the perspective and sung by men. They're not sung by teenage boys, they're sung by men about teenaged girls. And you would think by the 80s somebody would have, like, you know, raised their hand and said, no, this is why, what is it about 16-year-old girls that we're celebrating, and why are we so excited about them? And as a mom at this point, I just can't move past this obsession anymore. I'm so upset about it. That was my takeaway. And then he gets the panties. He gets the panties.
Yeah, what
and
a weird
off
scene.
His
yeah.
old girlfriend for the panties, which he doesn't even know if he's going to get a hold of this girl, but at least he's got the underwear.
Yeah, that's...
I don't know.
That scene confused me even when I first watched the movie. I was like,
yeah.
as a young child, I was like, is that a thing? Like, I was so confused by that scene always and continue to be.
You're like a little 13-year-old being like, is that how dating high school works?
Yeah, I was like...
You trade underpants?
And I was confused as to, like, why... All these freshman boys are paying just to see underpants.
Just to see underpants.
Yeah.
He could have bought some.
Go to any department store and they're just there.
They sell them. Yeah, yeah. They're right there. They won't not let you buy them just because you're a boy.
Right.
Like, they will, you can just buy them.
Yeah.
They'll be like, here they are.
Oh, the implications are so bad because it means they want evidence that he didn't just buy them. They're going to, like, handle them in a way that...
Well, there is that scene
so
on the
mad.
Bus where she gets up and Anthony Michael Hall sniffs her seat, which is so weird. That is.
He also, the first time she tries to get up, he grabs her and pulls her back down.
He is a terrifying little nerd.
Little creep. And creep boy.
I mean, he's not going to get better because his like boy and buddy is Jake Ryan, who's also just teaching him to be a creep. Mm-hmm. Who's like, I can violate my girlfriend, but you go ahead and do it.
Yeah, I'm going to trade you. I'll let you drive her home if you give me those underpants. But you got to make sure she gets home. Don't just leave her in some parking lot, is what he tells him.
Yeah.
So he knows exactly what he's telling him to do.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, just take her somewhere and have sex with her while she's unconscious. It's like, Jesus.
It's, yeah.
Beyond that, I mean, like, the kid can't drive. He's handing over his girlfriend.
Yeah, he could have killed her.
I guess at this point. Yeah. And he says out loud, I can't drive. I don't have a license. And he's like, whatever. I don't care.
Yeah, Jake Ryan is so mad. Most privileged little boy there is.
He's so privileged. What were you going to say?
No, just in the fact that he takes out this car. He's like, yeah, take my dad's car. That's a Rolls Royce. Doesn't understand what that means. He's like, this is what all cars are. And then doesn't care about his dad's property at all. I wouldn't have done that with my dad's Volvo.
No, like he does. Yeah, that's what I was going to say is like, he doesn't know what a Rolls Royce is. Like he's so.
He just assumes that's what cars are.
Yeah, he has no idea.
I got the sense that he was annoyed by how all the kids trashed his parents' house. So I think that's like the one piece of his personality that we're supposed to respect, that he's mad that his girlfriend brought people over without his permission and they trashed all his parents' stuff. So maybe at this point he's like, whatever, I don't care, I'm already in trouble. I got to get this girl home. But I don't want to do it myself. Maybe that's the most sympathetic thing I can think of to say about this character.
No, I think we can split that apart. Like I imagine any other weekend he would have been right there with them getting trashed and screwing up his house, but it's because he wants to go upstairs and try to call this 16-year-old girl who he knows is interested in him and he knows is a virgin.
Super polite to the grandparents, I guess, is his redeeming quality.
Yeah.
He's good. He has a good phone voice and personality.
So he sends, we see he doesn't do anything else that night after he sends the geek in his Rolls Royce to assault and maybe kill his girlfriend in an accident because he doesn't know how to drive. So he just wanted the geek out of the house so he could be alone with those underpants.
Yeah.
Yeah. We know he doesn't do anything else. He doesn't leave the house again.
Yeah, he was drinking everybody's empties and gonna chill.
Gonna hang out with these underpants.
Yeah.
Gosh, what a film.
Yeah.
It is kind of funny in some spots.
It is.
Well, I mean, the saving thing is these outstanding lady comedians who carry the whole thing.
Oh my God, they're so good.
Yeah. Their funny parts.
I feel certain that like Joan Cusack was just supposed to be like an extra or something. And like, oh, she's hilarious.
She's so
Because she doesn't have any lines. Just her doing business with this back brace, this halo that she's wearing on.
Yeah, she could have been in a Marx Brothers movie with that thing. It's so good. Everything is like wiping her mouth with that part of her sweater is just so great. And then, the sister at the wedding when they're all throwing rice as they're exiting the church and she's, like, jumping up and trying to catch the rice like a fish makes me laugh every single time.
She takes off her, like, under the pinafore. What's it called? Not pinafore. She takes off the slip just, like, walks out of it.
Yeah.
So good.
Sits in the front seat with the driver. Like, let's go.
There's also Carolyn, his girlfriend, has a great moment when she's acting drunk, which, again, she's a really funny when she's acting drunk, where they go to take the picture, and she just, like, wakes up like any drunk white girl that I think we've all been at some point, and just like cheers! Picture, and, like, super stoked on the picture, and it's like, that is the most relatable part of that movie.
I also laugh every time when the grandmother picks up right as Jake's hanging up. He says, eat me. It's like, who was it? I don't know. What did they want? Sex.
The grandmother's great.
So there's some good stuff in there. But man, it's so unlike The Breakfast Club, which I think fared much, much better. This movie is very, very dated.
Yeah, it's hard to watch now. Yeah. Like, the first 20 minutes, I had to get over that none of these characters were likable or redeemable, and it was a little hard. And then every time that gong sounded, I was like, oh, God, not again, please. I can't watch any more of this horrible.
I enjoy Molly Ringwald's performance in it. I do think she gets a teen girl right, because she was a teen girl. But yeah. I think John Hughes inadvertently, like, wrote something in here that he didn't mean to, which is that she, here's what I just realized, is that she's on her period too, because she's in the same house with her sister, and her, like, up and down of this day is probably her, like, emotional, you know, what a real teenager is going through on the first day of her period or right before her period, where you cry easily or you get angry. And because there's this scene in the dance where Anthony Michael Hall's character comes over and tries to dance with her, and he just kind of spazzes out and acts like a freak, and he falls down, and she runs away crying like he violated her. Like this was the most horrible moment that's ever happened to her, and I never understood what she's crying about. Like, she runs, physically runs out of the space and is in tears. It doesn't make sense, but it does make sense if you're a teenage girl and everything's, like, heightened.
Oh, yeah.
And you're already
you'll cry.
In a weird spot in your head. And it's your birthday, and nobody remembered, and your sister's getting married. And, like, if you try to put yourself in her head, I think she does a perfectly fine job with the material.
Oh, absolutely. And then another
she
part.
She was given.
Another part, speaking on that, is that rang really true to me, is that the whole day she's pissed at her parents. They didn't wish her happy birthday. And she's been thinking about this all day and really stewing. And, like, at 16 and you have those hormones and you're just ready to be angry,
ready
especially your parents. And then the minute her dad comes up and apologizes, has that sticky of, like, no, it's okay, Dad. Like, he couldn't actually do it. She couldn't actually bring herself to yell at her parents, which was, like, super true. Like, you spend your whole day, like, getting worked up and, like, oh, I'm really going to.
Cultivating that righteous anger.
Right.
Yeah.
You're really going to, like, tear them down and they're going to respect you. And then the minute they're like, I'm sorry, you're like, oh, okay.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. Thanks
for this
nice
talk. She keeps it together for the wedding, too, which is the part where she should have, like, been, I have something to say about my sister getting married right now while she's drugged. She should have been the character to stand her ground on that one.
Right, but yeah, she didn't learn anything.
Like, she keeps it together.
You can kind of tell it was written in like, 2 days.
Yeah. Like, on a Coke binge in 2 days.
Maybe would have added arcs for some of these characters. Yeah.
I mean, hopefully Long Duck Dong ran away.
I hope he escaped.
The part where she takes the four tranquilizers or four
muscle relaxers
for a period. That's not a thing. John Hughes did not. Where did he come up with anybody taking a muscle relaxer for periods? Like, that's the part where he needed a woman coming in and saying, no, we just take Tylenol. Like, she would not do that. That's not a realistic
action. It wouldn't
help
either. Like, it's.
No, it's not a muscle cramp.
It's not a muscle cramp.
Yeah, there.
Unless
I mean,
she's got, like,
there's a couple times where,
issues.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's a couple times where John Cusack could have used a woman in this writer's room.
John Hughes,
Cusack. Whatever. The Cusacks are both in this, and they're great.
They are.
No disrespect to the Cusacks in this movie.
Yes, they play their parts wonderfully.
They do.
Absolutely. That bass. He does the bass.
Oh yeah, when he's there. When I saw that, I was like, oh my God. I know exactly who you grow up to be, and it is John Cusack.
And you write for Cracked, probably. You are adorable. You should be on staff. Aww. Just that line, just that movement. Those three guys are my favorite parts of the movie, other than the female comedians, because they're just too likeable, too good. Other than taking the panties and selling.
Other than taking the panties and then like being so stoked to go outside and take that picture.
Right.
This
barely conscious woman in the back of this car.
Yeah, that they think that's cool too.
Okay, but I take it all back.
Yeah, but you know, it was a different time. It was very clear to me that it was a different time.
I'm so glad I did not watch this with my daughters. I almost asked them to come in and watch it with me over the weekend. It was at the point where the boobs came on. I was like, whoop, I missed a terrible moment with my children.
Yeah.
I'm glad they are not in the room.
Yeah.
There are a lot of teachable moments in it, I guess.
Yeah, it was a very confusing movie for me when I watched it with my mother. So And I did not ask any questions. I was just like, all right, that's a thing I've seen now.
Yep.
I'm a little more jaded.
Just going to absorb that and move right along.
Yeah.
Just going to repress that. Get that
shove
way
it down.
Down.
Yeah.
Shove it way down inside there. All right, we can move on.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's pretty much it. We're hitting the wrap up and final thoughts here. Anybody have any? Do you guys have any? Chris, do you have any final thoughts about 16 Candles and where it ranks in terms of Hughes movies and the films in general?
It's not looking good. I think that I had a higher opinion of it before I rewatched it, for sure. I knew there was some racism. I knew there was some casual inappropriateness. But, yeah, I would call out all the performances were really good, other than Jake Ryan. Don't like him. But all the performances were great. I'm glad that John Hughes got better at writing about teenagers. I'll say that.
Yeah.
That's true. That's fair. Yeah. Bridget, any final thoughts?
I have such a fond memory of this movie, but like Christy said, it's really difficult to watch now. There's just about every sort of just bad move under the sun, from like sexism to racism. They drop the other F-bomb.
Yeah.
Several times. Like every
very
single character, like from Molly Ringwald to the nerd to Jake Ryan, like everyone says that derogatory term for gay people. And it's hard to watch now, but again, there are some really, really delightful moments in this. And you see where John Hughes is going, but
yeah,
it's not,
yeah.
It aged terribly. I was stoked when I found out we were doing this movie, and I was like, I can't wait to watch it again. And then I watched it, and I was like, I am deeply uncomfortable.
Oh, I'm sad, man. Yeah. All right, so we're done here. Well, we want to talk to you about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @CrackMoviePod. Please hit us up with your thoughts. We want to hear what you think, what you want us to discuss, what you thought about the movie. I've been Tom, Bridget, and Christy. Christy, where can we find you online?
I'm on Twitter. Herein ID is what I call myself. It doesn't make sense anymore. It sounds like Herein Id. It's supposed to be Herein Idaho, but you'll find. You'll look me up. They'll find me.
Bridget, where can we find you?
Find me at Bridget Tweets, which, like Christie's, ends up being three T's. so it doesn't quite hold up as well as it should, but at Bridget Tweets is where you can find me on Twitter.
All right. Well, thank you guys both so much for coming on and doing the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been fun.
I was fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Fun and dark.
All right. Come back next week, everybody, where we're going to be talking about...
Oh, yeah.
It's Ferris Bueller. We can make that sound like I'm not a dumbass. Yeah.
I know what you're
swing
doing.
Swing and a miss.
Take a bow, bow. Bow.
Hi, this is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Frank Santopadre. Please welcome to the show, Norman Lear.
Who happened to make it also to Gilbert Gottfried and his podcast.
Ira Glass.
Very happy to be here.
This is Joyce Van Patten.
Hi, this is Frank Conniff.
Hi, I'm Dee Wallace.
Hi, this is Tom Bergeron.
Hey, everybody, this is Tommy James.
Hey, I'm Clint Howard.
Hi there, I'm Jackie the Joke Man Marley.
Hi, I'm Bobcat Goldthwait. I don't do that voice anymore. Well, I guess if you gave me money. You're listening to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast.
What an introduction. It gave me shit chills.
Damn.
Thank you, Johnny.
Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast, available on iTunes, Earwolf, Stitcher, and wherever podcasts can be heard. New episodes every Monday, with bonus episodes on Stitcher Premium every Thursday. Go to gilbertpodcast.com for more info.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.